This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The national media spent most of the day yesterday interpreting the Doug Jones win. What did they get right and what did they get wrong? We go there now on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. It's great to be with you this morning. I am Caleb Colquitt. And I got to tell you, it's interesting that the whole world has cared about Alabama for the past about 24 hours, and then they'll forget about it. But because of the Roy Moore defeat the other day, with Doug Jones winning a Senate seat in Alabama, the first senator to win a Senate seat since, well, actually Richard Shelby back when he was a Democrat. So the first Democratic senator from Alabama since Shelby. And that is a big deal because he had to, of course, switch parties and then become a Republican to get reelected. So there's a lot in the national media right now talking about Alabama, what's going on with Alabama, what the victory in Alabama means. And there's a lot of it that I think has a shred of truth to it, but then gets overplayed by the national media, and we'll get into that in just a second. First of all, one of the big things that is outlined here that they have made a big deal about is what they call the end of Trumpism. So a lot of national pundits and political commentators believe that what Doug Jones winning means is that Trumpism is dead, that it's over, that Trump no longer has any real influence over people. Look, the truth is that Trumpism can't die because it's not a thing. It was never a thing. Not really, because the Trumpism that gets talked about is this groundswell of national populism, this nationalist populist movement, it never really happened. And this is something that Steve Bannon has been talking about, which, again, like I was saying the other day, one of the only silver linings that may have come out of yesterday is that Roy Moore's loss means that Steve Bannon has been completely discredited. Hopefully this means that people will not be listening to him. He's one of the most overplayed and overrated political strategists in the country right now, because he has a pretty solid track record of losing. He happened to guess right on Trump, but that's about it. And pretty much every time he's ever run an incumbent against an establishment Republican, that person loses. Now, we've had incumbents to defeat establishment Republicans through things like the Tea Party, through this movement that especially cropped up around the Obama administration about small government, lower taxes, constitutionalism. That was real. But this national populist thing that has been tried by, which is being referred to as Trumpism, that never happened. That groundswell didn't exist. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that here in a second. Populism, first of all, is a strategy, not an ideology. Populism means that you essentially say whatever is popular to stir up a base. But that's not a political strategy. It could be anything. For example, if communism is incredibly popular, you can go out and say, I'm a communist and support all the communist ideas, and you are technically also using populism. You could say that, and I'm just using some of the bad ones, it could be something that's completely benign. You could come out and say, I'm for patriotism, for example, and if patriotism is especially popular where you are, then you could say, I'm super patriotic and make everything about patriotism, and because it's popular, see, that's the thing. Populism doesn't mean anything. It's not an ideology. It's just a strategy that people use to collect votes. And so populism, first of all, can't really be an ideological movement because there's no such thing as an ideological populist movement. Populism is a strategy to get votes. So the whole Trumpism thing never really got started in the first place, which is why it can't really die, because it never had any legs to begin with. And here's something that's important to note as well. Every single time Trumpism has been tried without Trump. It has failed every single time. There were a lot of similarities between Roy Moore and Donald Trump, not necessarily in the way that they thought or the way that they would have voted, because, again, I'm talking about the populist side of this, which is an ideological bend, not really an ideology or a political philosophy, because I think that actually Trump and Roy Moore are very different in those regards. But as far as their appeal, the way that they were presented, the way that Bannon tried to market them to people, it was very much the same. It was everything that's being talked about negatively about these people is fake news, and this person is a culture warrior, somebody that is going to right all the wrongs and ride in on a white horse, in Roy Moore's case, quite literally. And every time it's been tried in every race across the country, he's tried to do it to unseat senators and House representatives three or four times before, since Trump got elected. Every single time a campaign tries to mimic the Trump model and use that to get elected, it always fails. Because Trumpism is about Trump, his ego, his personality, this larger-than-life persona, and nobody's been able to replicate that politically. So the idea that Trumpism is dead doesn't really work, because it only works with Trump anyway. Every single time Steve Bannon has tried to replicate that strategy with somebody else, and somebody that he's appointed and somebody that he's pushed, it always winds up failing, and failing miserably. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to give my bend one side or the other on this particular election. I'm just saying that comparatively, Roy Moore was a very weak candidate compared to what could have been presented. And so he didn't really have a lot of the things that traditionally you need in a candidate to win an election. I mean, that's been proven, because he lost an election. And I know that the allegations had a lot to do with that. I'm not undermining that. But he lost an election to a Democrat in Alabama. I think the proof is in the pudding. So, seriously, most Republicans could have run in this state. Most Republicans could have run in this state and walked away with that election without a second thought. Wouldn't have even had to campaign all that hard. And they know that, and that's why this has become such a big deal to the national media. Now, we all know that, talking about this, the national populist movement, we all know that nationalism is an ideological bend, but one that doesn't work and hasn't worked in a long time. It's been tried in America before. There are some people that are nationalist here in America, but it does not, like the alt-right, but there's not this massive groundswell. Trump has a lot of influence over a statistically significant base of about 20 or 30% of the country, and that's about it. The rest were just didn't really want Hillary Clinton. And so they're really overstating the importance of this election and its results, in my opinion. Because, like I've said many times before, Donald Trump himself really has no ideology. It's all about personality. It's about this persona that he has, that people like him, that people were able to get on board with him. And that was enough to get him in through the primaries. But as far as the general election, like I said, the only reason that he was able to win was because he was facing one of the worst candidates in the history of the country. I mean, the only candidate with a likability rating lower than Hillary Clinton was Donald Trump. In the past, I think they started doing likability ranking polls. The farthest back I could find them is maybe the mid-60s. So with this whole Trumpism being dead thing, if you're looking at it honestly, if you're looking at it objectively, the Trump thing never had legs. Donald Trump did. But as far as there being this groundswell of ideological people that were in the same mindset as Donald Trump and Steve Bannon, that never happened. There's a statistically important block that really likes Trump, but that's not the same thing. That's not an ideological movement, because Trump's ideology changes basically with the hour. So you can't really, pin down and say specifically that this ideology, there are people that think this way that are like-minded going along with this movement. So I do think they're overstating the importance of it. I do think that there is some really important lessons to take from yesterday's election, and we're going to get there in a second and see about how their analysis went of what this means for the GOP going forward. And I'm going to give my analysis and my rebuttal on that in just one moment. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to get in, you can do that. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals in his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. Benjamin Franklin.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, let me know what is on your mind, what you're thinking. You know, is my analysis spot on? Are there some spots to it? Do you want to offer another opinion? You can do that at 860-1440, or you can do it on Twitter. At Tactics Radio would be the way to do that. By the way, before we do move on, and I am going to talk a little bit more about the election and the fallout and how the media reacted to it. But before I do that, I do want to mention that you can win a four-pack of tickets here to the 2017 Camellia Bowl to see Middle Tennessee, the Blue Raiders, take on the Arkansas State Red Wolves on Saturday, December the 16th. So very quickly approaching you. If you want tickets to the game, you can call right now, 860-1440. If you'll go on the air, you can be entered in that drawing. And that will be December 16th at 7 p.m. at Crampton Bowl. For more details, you can go to thecamelliabowl.com. Oh, sorry, just camelliabowl.com. Camelliabowl.com. So that is the web address if you want to get some tickets for yourself, or you can just call in and win a four-pack right now. 860-1440 would be the way to do that. So the real question is, does this spell trouble for the GOP down the road? I think that this shows that there is a real threat of motivated, mobilized Democrat voting base. There is a Democrat voting base that, because Donald Trump is in office, because this is something that Americans have done over the past couple of times, and we saw it with Obama. We're just seeing the reverse now that Donald Trump is in the White House. Because, for whatever reason, Americans seem to care a lot more about who's in the White House as opposed to who's in the Senate or the House or their own state representatives or legislators, even though those people probably more directly affect their lives. Because Americans really, really care about who's in the White House, you have this incredibly motivated, mobilized Democrat base that is ready to get out, ready to vote. And I think that that was at least somewhat part of the reason that Doug Jones was able to get out and vote. I mean, look at the voter turnout in a state where Republicans outnumber Democrats about 2-1. What this election really shows is there are a lot of Democrats that probably wouldn't have voted normally and wouldn't have voted, especially in a special election, that are really motivated to get out and vote now. And that's true in Alabama. That's true in every state across the country. So I do think that they are at least somewhat accurate in assessing that that is part of what led to the Doug Jones victory, that there is this backlash against Trump in the same way there was a backlash against Obama back in the day, and we saw state legislators and governorships, guys like Scott Walker elected, I mean, in super, super blue states. So there is this backlash against the president that is going to be taking place. And because of that, because you're going to see part of that that is a reaction to who is in the White House, it is important for the GOP to sort of read the tea leaves and act accordingly. Because, like I said, for whatever reason, Americans just really care about who's in the White House more than they care about their own state legislators and U.S. representatives, that kind of thing. So that is going to be a real threat. You can look at what happened in Virginia and see that. Now, I think the Virginia, the Democrat victory in Virginia is a much more accurate way to look at it because, again, Roy Moore was a very weak candidate and really we should have had somebody like Mo Brooks running for that seat and they would have won easily. So it's a bit of a odd thing to read it by, but I do think that there is an aspect of that that is true, that there is this Democrat backlash against Trump and whoever's party happens to be in the White House, that party just kind of gets complacent for a little while because Americans care about who's in the White House a lot. So when, you know, quote unquote, your guys in the White House, they tend not to vote on midterm elections nearly as much. So this is something to be concerned about. I'm not trying to understate that there is a real threat to the GOP down the road. Now, yesterday was a big sign of that, but it ought not be overstated. This doesn't mean that Alabama is going to turn blue. This doesn't mean that in the upcoming midterm elections that you're going to see a lot of Democrats elected, that you're going to see Democrat House members taking. I just don't see that happening much unless there's an odd kind of weird House election going on in one of the districts in Alabama. I don't see that happening in super red states like Alabama. But there is going to be that real groundswell of Democrat voters. And so in mixed states and states that are kind of purple, you're definitely going to see that. You're going to see Democrats, I think, probably flip the House. With the way that the Senate stacks up very favorably in, you know, in regards to the Republican majority, I don't think that they'll be taking the Senate the first time around. They may take it, you know, after a little while. But I don't think that in this, you know, next midterm election that the Senate's going to all of a sudden be flipped and it's going to be Democrat as well. I think that's a bridge too far. Although, granted, I thought that Roy Moore was going to win. So keep in mind, I'm not 100% on elections. In fact, I tend to get elections wrong a lot. Now, I'm great about talking policy, great about talking ideology. If you want somebody that's going to predict an election, you probably need to steer clear of me, and I'll go ahead and warn you about that right now. But, you know, it is what it is. So, with Moore as a candidate, you had a lot of baggage. He was terrible at campaigning. Some of the spokespeople he put out there for the national media were just awful. I mean, massive, massive blunders. The guy that was saying that Muslims can't hold office because you have to swear on a Bible, which is not the case. I think it was the same guy who did that interview with Jake Tapper, who was saying that Roy Moore believes that homosexual activity ought to be made illegal because it's a sin, something like that. I mean, just I don't know what was going on inside the Roy Moore campaign, but it was a very, very poorly run campaign, and he got like the worst spokespeople ever. I don't know that Judge Moore actually believes some of those things, but he shouldn't have had spokespeople that would have been willing to articulate them one way or the other. So just an odd thing to use as your gauge. However, this does say something important, and I do want to state the importance of this. If you are a Republican and you were in Washington, this means that you have an expiration date and it is coming quickly. This means that you have a year. That's it. You've got a year to get those policies through because we have the House, the Senate, and the White House. Now is the time to start passing things. Now is the time to get the agenda through, get tax reforms done, get rid of Obamacare, because in a year, I think what this is indicative of is you're going to see Democrats make massive gains, if not take the House. So this needs to light a fire under their butts. They need to start getting things done and getting it done quickly. Let this be a warning to you, Republicans. We'll be back in just a second.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Hebrews 8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in and get those four-pack of Camellia Bowl tickets, which we are giving away. So 860-1440 would be the way to do that. You can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. Now, that's not going to get you any tickets, but you can do it, and we might read those on the air. So be sure to do that as well. Now, the other night, I think this was actually a couple nights ago, but the story from the Washington Post just came out the other day. Jimmy Kimmel goes into this long political monologue about what's going on with this thing called the CHIP program, which is a federal program that helps kids that don't, you know, they don't really qualify for Medicaid, but they don't have coverage. And so he goes into this long diatribe about it. But the thing is, his facts were almost completely backwards. I mean, just about everything that he said was actually wrong. And even the Washington Post, which, let's face it, is not exactly a conservative-leaning newspaper, had to come out and do a fact check on it because their readers were requesting it and tried to rebuttal it. Now, to give you a little bit of context, he started doing this in the Obamacare debate when they were talking about repealing Obamacare, and it got a lot of attention. It didn't necessarily boost his ratings or anything like that, but it got a lot of attention. A lot of people in political spheres were starting to talk about it, and so because of that, and because it got him a lot of attention, it started to get more and more frequent. He started doing these long political monologues on things like gun control and so on and so forth. And you can remember that he did that. I think it was in the wake of the Vegas shooting. So he's done this more and more frequently, and it's getting to the point to where it's not necessarily becoming an everyday thing, but it's becoming a very common occurrence on Jimmy Kimmel's show for him to go into these long political speeches. And none of them have been particularly elegant or informative, but he keeps insisting upon doing them. And he's even had, I think it was Chuck Schumer actually write part of one of his monologues for him. But here's the thing. Jimmy, as one professional broadcaster to another, and I know he's probably not listening to this, but seriously, stick to what you're good at. You're good at telling jokes and interviewing celebrities and having a good time and entertaining people. You have a real gift for that. Stick to doing that. Because you're not great at doing political commentary. It's just not working for you. And seriously, if he continues down this path of doing, it's really going to kill his show. Because that's not what people tune in to watch. In fact, I would argue that just like I was talking about with ESPN when ESPN tried to get super political, that's the place where you go when you don't want to deal with the news and politics. That's where you go for escapism. You want to relax. You want to unwind at the end of the day. That's the last place you want politics to start interfering. And so, yeah, a lot of your liberal buddies in Hollywood may be cheering and applauding you for doing stuff like this, but believe me, it's not helping you with your audience. So, you know, if I start doing stand-up comedy, I'll take advice from you, seriously. But as a political commentator, you really ought to either put in the time and effort to really know your stuff and do your research, or you need to stay out of it altogether, because this is where you start getting into trouble. So the Washington Post comes out the other day, and they started doing this fact check on what he said in his latest political monologue. And like I said, keep in mind, this is the Washington Post. They have a very clear and distinct left bend. They do not like Republicans. They're one of the, I wouldn't say the farthest left paper, but they're like right in there with the New York Times. They're not quite to the Huffington Post level yet, but they lean pretty hard left. And even they had to talk about it. First of all, what bugged me about it is he comes out with his son on stage, and I don't have a problem with that at all. But then he starts using his son's heart condition as kind of a political weapon to give him some level of credence or credibility as to his expertise on this matter. My advice would be to not use your family's medical problems as a political weapon. Like, I don't wish any harm at all to come to his son. Only the best for him. I hope that, and because he's getting really good health care and because we have such sophisticated advanced medicine in this country, I'm really glad that he's getting the care that he hopes for and that he's doing really well. But don't use your or your family's political or your medical ailments as a excuse to do political monologues or to use that as saying that I'm the expert, I'm the person that you should be listening to on this. We've gotten to this weird place in this country to where having a problem is seen as almost the same thing as being an expert on all things concerning that problem. This is actually a logical fallacy called an appeal to authority, but the person doing it isn't even actually an authority. So it's actually a false appeal to authority. You know, an appeal to an authority is the worst kind of logical appeal. You've got an appeal to emotion, you've got an appeal to logic, and then you have an appeal to authority, which is, because I'm an expert in this area, you should heed my advice. That's the weakest of all logical appeals, and on top of it, this one isn't even an accurate one, because this doesn't make Jimmy Kimmel an expert on politics or, you know, the way that Washington works or any of those things. This is just, my son has a heart condition, ergo you should be listening to me and what I think politically. Because it affects some kids that might have a condition. In this case, it doesn't even necessarily affect kids that would have his son's heart condition. But he's just saying, because I have a kid that's not perfectly healthy, I'm an expert on all things regarding the political, you know, inner workings of healthcare that might apply to children. It doesn't make any sense. It's a false call to authority. And I'm somebody that can say this and understand it because you guys know that I have cancer, but I don't use that as an appeal when I'm talking to people. You know, when I talk about healthcare policy, it's because I do my research and actually study this stuff. I don't say, well, I have cancer, so you should be listening to me on how this all this works. And I'm an uninsured person that has cancer, and I'm still not using that as a call to authority. I talk to you about it. I talk to you about my experiences about it. But I don't say, you should listen to me, and I have this level of expertise above the average person because of this. If you're going to do that, actually do the research and know your stuff so you don't have to make those false calls to authority. But, you know, that's just the debater in me making that point. So there are a couple things that he does mention and talk about, and he goes off into a monologue. So I wanted to do just a couple things here. I wanted to play a couple clips of this monologue and just kind of go through it piece by piece. So let's go ahead. This one is from Jimmy Kimmel the other night, clip one.
Hebrews 8.
That is my intro. That is not the same clip.
Around 9 million American kids whose parents make too much money to qualify for Medicaid but don't have access to coverage, affordable coverage to their jobs, which means it almost certainly covers children you know. About 1 in 8 children are covered only by CHIP. And it's not controversial. It's not a partisan thing. In fact, the last time funding for CHIP was authorized was in 2015. It passed with a vote of 392-337 in the House and 92-8 in the Senate. Overwhelmingly, Democrats and Republicans supported it until now. Now CHIP has become a bargaining chip. It's on the back burner while they work out their new tax plans, which means parents of children with cancer and diabetes and heart problems are about to get letters saying their coverage could be cut off next month. Merry Christmas, right?
Okay, so here's the issue with this. First of all, it's still a bipartisan issue. Whether you agree with the program or not, whether you like Republicans or like Democrats, doesn't matter. This is still overwhelmingly supported by both parties. Republicans still overwhelmingly support this program. And funding did technically run out back in September, but most of the states, in fact, all but 3 of the states have gotten funding that they had back pay from the funding of this project in the past that they've been able to use to cover these expenses, and Congress knows that, which is why it hasn't necessarily been fully funded. And in the 3 states where that has taken place, they've been able to fund it independently through a stopgap program. So what he's saying is actually completely untrue. There is no threat right now to funding this program. It is part of the normal budget-making process that happens at the end of the year, like a lot of programs. And so he's vastly, vastly overstating the danger here when it comes to this program, and he is completely missing the mark when he claims that Republicans no longer support this, because whether you think this program should be there or not, whether or not you like government spending on healthcare for any reason, I mean, this thing was passed back in 1992, it's been around for a while, this has not suddenly become some kind of political football the way that Jimmy Kimmel is describing it. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Republicans overwhelmingly support this program. Right now, there's just a debate on how to fund it and where the money's going to come from. Also, there was a stopgap approved earlier this month, so there has been no break in coverage. People aren't getting letters saying your kid is no longer covered. This isn't happening. He's saying something that is completely untrue and that there's really no danger in right now. Furthermore, the CHIP program has never been a part of the tax reform negotiation. See, this is one thing that he's saying. Well, it's become a bargaining chip, and they're using it as a bargaining chip with kids' health to get their tax reform. No, that was never part of the discussion. There's no record of a single representative, Republican or Democrat, that is saying, okay, well, with tax reform, we need to start talking about this. Congress doesn't just, regardless of what Jimmy Kimmel may think, Congress doesn't focus on one issue at a time. They're doing several legislative things all at once, and there's several balls in the air at a time. they're not all only focusing on one project, and if there is a project that is not funded or that is not being, you know, done to satisfaction, that everything else goes away. That's not how Congress works. They don't just stop doing everything else so they can focus on one thing. And so the CHIP program not having an agreement reached on it yet has nothing to do with the tax reform bill. He's conflating two things that aren't connected. This is part of the normal year-end budget negotiations, which happen at the end of every fiscal year. And like I said, the only debate right now is how to fund it, not whether or not it will be funded. They're just looking for the money right now. They're not saying that we should stop funding this. Also, and here's one thing that he's trying to lend the idea that the GOP is so focused on tax reform that they're ignoring this. The GOP-led House already passed the CHIP reauthorization bill 242 to 174 votes. Most of the opposition was from the Democrats. Not because they want to stop the CHIP program from happening, but because of budgeting offsets. So the idea that anybody that is debating how we're going to pay for if that's the case, then the people in Congress that Jimmy Kimmel is accusing of stopping this program would have to be the Democrats, because they're the ones that voted against it in the House. Now, I don't think that that's the case. The Democrats aren't trying to defund CHIP. They are just disagreeing with where the money should come from. But the point is, he's trying to make it out like these are, you know, the Republicans, these evil, hardened Republicans are just worried about getting these massive tax breaks. And because of that, they're putting CHIP on the back burner. That's not what's happening. In fact, there is so little danger to this. To this not getting funded. I mean, it's going to be funded. And because there is so little danger, the Democrats are out there voting against it because they know it's going to get funded. All they're doing is arguing about where that money's going to come from. So he's completely overblown his case. We're going to get to another clip where he kind of goes off the rails even more here in just a second. Before we do that, though, I want to tell you about my good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Right here in Montgomery, they've been in Montgomery for 50 years, and there's a very good reason for that. They know what they're doing. They have a level of expertise that most people don't. They have experience. It's not a fly-by-night organization. They've been here for 50 years because they give great service at a great price. That's really all it boils down to. Anything that you need from, you know, just getting somebody to take a look at that check engine light or get your oil changed or get your tires rotated or major engine repair, hey, it's getting cold. Some cars are having a little trouble starting. Some cars are having issues with the heater. You got problems with that? There's one place you need to go, and that's Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. We had a little snow and a little bit of ice this weekend. That's something that you're going to have to look out for. It could happen again this season. You don't need to be riding around on those bald-faced tires if that's the case. You need good tires, especially for this time of year. The place to get them is Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center over on the Troy Highway. Go where I go for all my truck's needs. You believe me, you're going to be satisfied with what you get. You're getting a quality product, and you're getting it at a great price. So go see them on the Troy Highway today. That is Woodham's Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. We're going to play one more clip from Jimmy Kimmel when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The most effectual means of securing the continuance of our civil and religious liberties is always to remember with reverence and gratitude the source from which they flow. John Jay, First Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Let me know what's on your mind. You can also tweet us at Tactics Radio if you'd like to. Now, getting a little bit more into this monologue by Jimmy Kimmel, there were a couple other things that he said that I really want to get into, so we're just going to go ahead and play that second clip. Let's go with clip two.
So this happened because Congress, about 72 days ago, failed to approve funding for CHIP. Since the first time since it was created, two decades ago, this is literally a life and death program for American kids. It's always had bipartisan support, but this year they let the money for it expire while they work on getting tax cuts for their millionaire and billionaire donors. And imagine getting that letter, literally not knowing how you'll be able to afford to save your child's life. This is not a hypothetical. About 2 million CHIP kids have serious chronic conditions. I don't know about you. I've had enough of this. I don't know what could be more disgusting than putting a tax cut that mostly goes to rich people ahead of the lives of children. Why hasn't Chip been funded already? If these were potato chips they were taking away from us, we would be marching on Washington with pitchforks and spears right now. So once again, I'm asking you, Billy's asking you to make two phone calls you shouldn't have to make. Jam the House and Senate phones tonight, tomorrow, as long as it takes. Tell them to take a break from tax cuts for a minute and fully fund Chip immediately.
Okay, first of all, I would like to point out that even as someone who's not a professional comedian, that Chip joke was incredibly lame. I mean, looking at it, just because you make a potato chip joke just because Chip is the name of the program, I mean, that's a pretty low bar regardless. But, you know, I'm not a comedian. He is still. I think that that was really, really a stretch. But granted, it was the only attempt at something funny he tried to say in the entire thing, which is typically the point of a comedic monologue. I mean, I'm not exactly a stand-up expert, but most people don't go to see comedians to get into long political discussions. But regardless, looking at that, first of all, he's wrong again, because Chip is not part of the tax reform debate. Never has been. Never been talked about that way. So he's wrong on that. It's not part of the tax reform negotiations, but those reforms would reduce taxes across the board, according to the Washington Post and the Joint Tax Committee. So you are getting a tax break, but it's not just for quote-unquote millionaires and billionaires like he asserts that it is. It would be across the board. And again, that's not according to me or not according to Breitbart or The Blaze or any right-leaning news sources. That's according to the Washington Post and the Joint Tax Committee. So the idea that the tax reform is just for millionaires and billionaires is, first of all, simply untrue. So that's not the case, and it's not even part of those negotiations anyway. Also, the only thing right now, like I said, being debated is how to fund it. The House's GOP plan, which passed, was actually to fund it by cutting Medicaid subsidies for people that make over $500,000 a year. So he's talking about the GOP only caring about these evil rich people when the House's GOP plan, their proposal, was to not only fund CHIP, and it passed, but it was to fund CHIP at the expense of people making over $500,000 a year with their Medicaid subsidies. So he's making this case that simply doesn't exist, that the GOP is only for rich people, even though the Republicans are the one that wanted to fund it at the expense of people making over $500,000 a year. Now, again, whether you support that plan or not, you can't say that the GOP is in the pocket of these evil rich people and that's the reason they haven't funded it. They already passed that plan. So he doesn't know anything about what's going on here, and he makes that painfully obvious. Republicans actually passed a plan where the rich would be the ones paying for CHIP. So he gets the whole thing backwards. He does this call to action against all these evil people in Congress, and he says that his son, who's too young to speak, is asking you to do this while he's holding him there. I think it's disgusting that he's using his family's health problems as an excuse to go into these long and frankly untrue political diatribes and do these calls to action.
This is from 72.
Sorry about that. Let's look at this and look at it objectively. Is this really what you want from your late night TV? Because I've gotten to the point to where, honestly, I can't really watch a lot of late night TV because it's so much of this political commentary. And Jimmy Kimmel's the worst offender of it, but I've gotten to where I don't even really watch Conan, who I was a big fan of for a long time. Is this really what you want from your entertainment? I think that really at the end of the day, Kimmel needs to either stick to jokes or do the work and research to actually know his stuff if he's going to talk about this stuff and do it accurately. Hour 2 coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
A columnist from The Root claims a viral video of a man saving a rabbit from a fire sums up everything wrong with whiteness. We go there now on Tactics. Don't you know? Welcome back, everybody, to Tactics Radio. Hour 2 is on now. I'm Caleb Cockwood, for those of you who may not know. Great to be with you this morning. So this is one story that I had to pick up because of the bizarreness of it. There's this columnist from The Root, which is an organization, it's a magazine kind of thing that primarily markets to black people. And he wrote this piece on their website that claims that a viral video of a guy saving a rabbit from a wildfire sums up everything that is wrong with whiteness. So just because of the bizarre factor, I had to get in on this one. First of all, this is one of the oddest stories I've seen in a long time, and that's why, just because of the sheer strangeness of it, I thought that I had to talk about this. I recommend reading it, because it is written to be dead serious and to be this, you know, very stone-faced political commentary on how terrible white people are, which makes it even funnier. Be warned, there is a lot of profanity if you do happen to check this out and read it. But, oh my gosh, I mean, it goes on and on and on. So, to set up exactly what this is talking about, there was this video that went viral a little while ago of this guy who's saving a rabbit from a wildfire in California. The trees and everything are burning up. And I mean, y'all know about what was going on in California. And there's this video that broke of this guy who runs in, saves a rabbit that's trapped, and carries it to safety. And somehow this guy, when you talk about people, there are people out there, you know, we didn't know that there's a lot of people that are not like this, but there are some that are, that will find racism in absolutely anything because they're just constantly looking for it. I think this is a incredibly exaggerated case of that being the way. I mean, the average person we know is not like this and doesn't see racism and everything, but if you can look at this and see everything wrong with white people in this video, I think that you might be looking a little too hard to try to find racism and everything. So first of all, he asserts that the fires in California were caused by white people because the spark that was supposed to have started it was caused by down power lines and compounded by global warming. Do black people not use electricity? Is that something that I've missed? Is that something in the culture that I've... Because every black person's house that I've ever been to, like from church or anything, all of them had electricity. Every single one. I've not run into one yet that didn't have electricity. But apparently down power lines are the white man's fault. I don't really get where the connection is to that one. And then second of all, he claims that because, according to a source that he cites, the wildfires could have been compounded or maybe the extent of them been lengthened because of global warming, that's also the white man's fault. Again, do black people not have any carbon emissions? Because even if you, I don't even accept that global warming is really a thing, but, or at least man-made global warming, I should clarify myself. But if we're talking about CO2 emissions, let's just pretend that the science works. Would that mean that black people don't also contribute to global warming? I don't understand where this becomes a race issue. But anyway, he just goes on and talks about how this is the epitome of this whole situation is just white people's fault. And the wildfires themselves are caused because of white people. Now, just to give you a little snippet of what this article is like, I wanted to read a little excerpt here. I'm not going to pretend that I understand something as complex as global warming, especially when I still don't even understand why my toaster heats Pop-Tarts quicker than Eggos. But I do know that colonialism and aggressive industrialism have had an adverse effect on our environment. And I also know that this is a byproduct of manifest destiny, an existential edict ingrained in white people where they believe that everything belongs to them. Okay, there's a couple things. First of all, here, Eggos are frozen. That's why your toaster heats up the Pop-Tarts quicker than it does the Eggos. They're frozen waffles, and even if you put them in the fridge and thaw them out, that still means that they're cold, as opposed to Pop-Tarts, which just come straight out of the cabinet. So, mystery solved. I solved that one for you. Just in case anyone was wondering, that is why the toaster does heat Pop-Tarts quicker than it heats Eggos. Now you know. And we can all go about with our lives not needing to explore that any further. And here's another thing. He betrays himself on his last point because this proves that he does use electricity. Because apparently he's got a toaster. So this guy is apparently also contributing to the downed power lines that caused this wildfire. I mean, it just, there's no rhyme nor reason or any sense of logic in this thing at all. I also really love this. He's saying, I don't really understand how global warming works. So I don't understand this concept. I just know white people are somehow to blame. And then he goes into this whole Manifest Destiny thing. By the way, Manifest Destiny? Yeah, that was coined by Andrew Jackson, who was the founder of the Democrat Party. So he's got a clearly leftist bend, but it was the Democrats that started the whole Manifest Destiny thing. That was a progressive idea. That was not a small government constitutionalist that came up with Manifest Destiny. And second of all, looking through this, the byproduct of, let's see, colonialism and aggressive industrialism. Aggressive industrialism is not necessarily a white person problem. In fact, the most industrialized, highly polluted areas are in China and India. Not a lot of white people there. Mostly Asians. Well, in fact, China and India, all Asians. Those are the people that live there. And so he acts as though, again, I don't even buy into the science, a lot of the science, and I call it pseudoscience, of global warming. But even if you did, and even if you're buying into this narrative, there's just absolutely no truth to anything that he's saying here. It doesn't make sense. So, I mean, I just don't know where all this is coming from. And then later on in the article, he goes off on how saving animals means more to white people than saving black people. First of all, did this guy completely miss the week of Hurricane Harvey? Did he just sleep through that entire, I don't know, week and a half of coverage? Because one of the things that I saw in that was a lot of people, black and white, helping neighbors, black and white, not really caring a whole lot about the skin color or the political affiliations or anything else. The same thing with, you know, the hurricanes down in Florida and later on with Puerto Rico. I mean, if you're looking at this, he's going off on this problem that really doesn't exist and using a really weird platform to jump off to get into discussing that problem in the first place. But what I wanted to get down to, and I did want to get serious here for just a second, because I've had a lot of fun with this, but I did want to mention this on a serious note. What this article reading through it most reminded me of was the rhetoric of the alt-right. And I know that this guy would probably cringe at me saying that, but it sounds like a white supremacist blog, looking through it. Because he systematically, everything that he has, he tries really, really hard to make these odd logical leaps to say that they were the fault of white people when all you would have to do is reverse it and say Jews or anything that's not white, and you basically have an alt-right article. And this is the point that I wanted to make. If you replace white with Jew, if you replace white in this article with Jew and then just read it like that, you're basically reading a piece by Richard Spencer. So it's the same racism. It's just directed in a different direction. It's the same terrible rhetoric and the same logical leaps that one seemed to have nothing to do with the other, just blaming one particular race for all of your problems. It's just directed in a different direction. And this tribalism and this racism that we have, it's the same stuff no matter who it's directed to. Why is that the case? Why is that seeming to be always the case? Because this problem stems from the same issue. Seeing people as a collective, seeing people as a homogenous group as opposed to individuals. See, that's how you get out of racism. by doing what Dr. King said, by judging people by the content of the character, looking at them as an individual person, someone created in the image of God, and looking past the color of their skin. That's how you combat racism. And you're going to have people like this and people like Richard Spencer and the white supremacy movement and the neo-Nazis that are always, always going to see people as just their skin color. But as Christians, what we have to do is we have to do what Christ did and what God recommends that we do, which is look past the flesh and look on the heart. Upon Further Review with Joe Hunk is coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 1:21, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in and get that four-pack of tickets for the Camellia Bowl. Or you can also tweet me at Tactics Radio, so you always have that option. Guys, it is Thursday. You know what that means. It is time for Upon Further Review.
After review, we're living on the field.
If you can talk sports, you can talk with any guy in the world.
When sports and politics meet, it deserves a second look.
After further review, the player disqualification is reversed.
Here with the ruling, it's Caleb Colquitt and Sports Radio 740's Joe Hunk with Upon Further Review.
Welcome into the program, Joe.
How's it going? I will say that I am excited about the Camellia Bowl. We've already got Middle Tennessee State in. We've already got Arkansas State in. I've got some friends in the radio business that are actually coming in today to get ready for it. They have alumni parties that are happening all around town. So it's going to be kind of fun the next couple of days with that. And we've got the parade
tomorrow
night. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, going to be a big parade. All right. So I did want to talk about this, though, and this is one of the things that I saw this. I was immediately like, this has got to be the story that we do tomorrow. Jose Canseco is in some hot water and will not be working for NBC Sports anymore. His contract is not going to be renewed. And I know this is probably not going to come as a massive shock to anybody, because this is how a lot of people lately, especially in the sports world, have gotten into trouble. Their Twitter feed.
Yes. You have to be very careful with your Twitter feed.
You do.
Very careful with it. Trust me, there's a lot of tweets that I've wanted to send out the last 48 hours that I have deleted.
Yes.
Totally deleted.
You got to be careful with Twitter, because I think Twitter kind of lends itself to that thinking out loud kind of mentality, to where you pop up to whatever just goes into your head, and that's not a good thing.
It's a release. It's an escape.
Right.
If you have an emotion, whether it's sadness, happiness, anger, whatever, it allows you to get that release, that instant release. Now, obviously, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Many times you do get a reaction, and you sit there and you look at it and go, man, I probably shouldn't have said that.
Yeah,
I can delete that.
There's a lot of Twitter. We need a word for Twitter regret. We need to invent that word. I don't know
Twitter.
Exactly. Twigret.
I don't know.
I don't know. It's not. It's
the
not
delete button. That's what.
Yeah,
Twitter.
That's what it should
the
be.
Delete button.
But anyway, so here's some of the tweets that are in question by Jose Canseco. First of all, what is going on with all these politicians molesting women? I've been molested by several women and never complained. The next one was, well, I mean, I've been beaten by women and taken advantage of by women and molested by women. I never complain, but it was kind of a turn on. The next one, I see the difference, I guess, because I was a good looking guy and these politicians look like a bag of boogers. And finally, these women complaining against sexual misconduct are just racist against ugly men. I don't know that you can be racist against ugly people. Ugly isn't a race.
I don't think he knows the definition of racist.
That's part of the problem.
I don't think he knows that definition at all.
I mean, you can discriminate against ugly people, but that's not the same as racism.
Again, Jose Canseco is 100% a person that we probably understand that he has something wrong with the mind. He probably has one concussion too many, okay? He's not that bright of a guy.
Well, I mean, yeah, great baseball player, but if you're going to be a political, or not a political commentator, if you're going to be a sports commentator with a sports organization like this, you're going to be the face of it, you have to be really careful with what you say.
And it's different. It's different for our avenue, because our avenue, we are paid to be A, be independent as far as our thinking, because
right.
we get paid to think differently. We get paid to try to be entertaining. We get paid to try to get reactions out of people.
Mm-hmm.
So for our avenue, it's different. If you are somebody that is in the news world, you aren't paid to think.
Well, you're also kind of your job is to not be controversial,
well,
honestly.
Your job is to report.
I mean, exactly.
Now, again, you can – the way that you report – now, again, we have many friends, and I have many friends in the sports business when it comes to news. And that's different than being an anchor on a television, because an anchor on television, you're literally reading a teleprompter. So when I say you're not being paid to think, I mean as a sense of you're being paid if you are
right.
an anchor to read the teleprompter. Now, a lot of times you may be the one writing it and you're doing it depending on what market you're in. Like, again, in a Montgomery, the a lot of times the anchors will be writing their own material. But at the same time, you're paid to report. Now, the way that your stories are done, the angles in which you take, those can show your personal beliefs and your personal ideas of the way a story should go, just on how you feel. I mean, again, just a little while ago over on 740, the picture was being painted about Jay Jacobs and the fact of, the Chick-fil-A Bowl had a press conference in Auburn yesterday, and
right.
it was and Jay Jacobs was there. Now, obviously, we all know that Jay Jacobs is just a figurehead.
Mm-hmm.
He has zero power, one bit. He has just about as much power as you and I do right now. He's just a face. And at one point in time, he was asked about about the Malzahn deal, and he's like, "Well, I had nothing to do with anything in the Malzahn deal." And so the question on 740 is, then why are you there? Like, what? We knew that you were just going to be a headpiece.
Right.
Okay, like that is your job, and that's the direction that you're going. But that was the angle that in which they were taking. With news people, and especially when you talk about somebody that is in that line of work where they are doing an Oakland A's broadcast, which is what he was doing. He was doing that. The job is always going to be to paint a good picture of your team. And you can look at, again, local angles of that is you can look at Rob Bramlett. You can look at the guys over at the Montgomery Biscuits. Whenever they're going to talk about their program, they're going to talk about it in a positive light. And that's what their job is. And if you don't do anything that will show it in a positive light,
and part
then you're
of
getting
the,
in trouble.
And part of being, like you said, painting it in that positive light, the part of the reason that they want you there is because you're a good public face for that organization, that when people see you, they think of their organization. And this is why they're distancing themselves from him now, because they don't want people to see Jose Canseco and associate the Oakland A's with this kind of thinking.
I don't understand why he was there to begin with.
I really don't either.
Because
to be honest,
outside of being a Bash brother and doing what he did in the early 90s and late 80s, outside of doing that, when has he ever actually painted the Oakland A's in a good light? I mean, again, I come from Huntsville, okay? I come from the place where he started using steroids, okay? If you've never read his book, when he went to Huntsville, that was the first time that he started using steroids, and that's when his numbers started jumping up. The bathroom that he talks about in his book about where he started shooting up steroids, I have been in that bathroom multiple times. Like, that's what you're talking about with Jose Canseco. And you look at him, and I guess it's because Mark McGwire is actually being a coach, and I guess Ricky Henderson is doing something else. Like, I don't understand why he was there to begin with. But Jose Canseco has not really painted a positive light on anything baseball-wise in the past few years because of, A, all the books that he's written, which I don't think he's lying about any of them. I just think that they're trying to shun him because they don't want the truth to actually be talked about, and he considers himself like the godfather of the steroid area, which he actually kind of is. But he's just not a positive figure to begin with in Major League Baseball, so I don't know why Oakland had him there to begin with.
Well, and that actually may be part of the reason that they found it so easy to sever ties with him, is because they already didn't necessarily see that he was adding a lot of value to it. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know.
And with his comments, look, again, he's been in Huntsville.
Yeah.
Which means he's been out to the bars in Huntsville. He went out to restaurants in Huntsville. And when you're around the town as much as I have, you hear stories about Jose Canseco. Okay?
Right.
Trust me, if Jose Canseco wants all the stories about his life to be shared, he may not want to say some things. Because I know things about stuff that he's done in bars. Because of stories that I've been told from, let's just say, females that he tried to, he says, molested. I know stories from females that he's tried to pick up, because one of them actually used to do my hair, and she used to share me stories with Jose Canseco because she always used to go to the bar he went to. So I kind of know stories myself. So if he doesn't, that's where part of this is that now we're in this day and age where if something happened to you 20, 25 years ago and he didn't like it, you automatically come out with it and ruin somebody's career.
That's the environment that we're in. So I do think that it probably is smart if those stories exist. And I imagine Jose Canseco is aware of that. He should probably tread lightly, especially on this issue.
Which, honestly, he doesn't really have a reputation to bury, to be honest with you, because his reputation is kind of shot to begin with. And, I mean, he's an egotistical person. I mean, that's who he is. He's an alpha male, and he is one of these guys that continues to thrive on being in power and over control. And if somebody tries to take that away from him, he just goes off and finds somewhere else to do it. And that's who Jose Canseco is, and that's who he's been for a long time.
All right, well, we've got to get to a break right now, but we'll be right back with more with Upon Further Review.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. Got Joe Hunkin here right now with me for Upon Further Review. And Joe, are you in the holiday spirit yet?
I am. My wife's birthday was last week. So part of her Christmas and / her birthday presents was to go over to ASF to see Christmas Carol.
Okay, cool.
And that show is amazing. And if you have time, go watch A Christmas Carol with ASF, because the set is tremendous. The makeup is amazing. And the whole story and the way that their interpretation of it is really cool. Like, it is the classic interpretation, but they have Charles Dickens actually, like, talking to you in between and stuff. So you haven't actually seen it, then it's really awesome to go over there and watch. And I did not know this until afterwards when we got home. My wife goes, "That's the first time I've ever seen that." And I went, "Wait, you've never, ever seen A Christmas Carol ever?
How do you
like never?" She goes, "No, I didn't know that what was going to happen next. I didn't know that they were going to like show him dying." And I went, wait,
how have you existed in America and not,
how have you never seen this?
Right.
like I'm sitting there and I knew everything that's happening, and the guy that plays Ebenezer's partner, the one that comes in at the very beginning, that dude was fantastic. That dude was fantastic, and he plays multiple parts in the whole play, but his part as his partner was really
Marley.
Good. Yeah, Marley. Yeah. His part in that was so awesome. And my wife, she was like grabbing my arm at times. I'm like, why are you this ain't scary. Like, what are you doing? And then she told me afterwards, and I was shocked. I went, so wait a second. You've never seen Scrooged. You have never seen Jim Carrey's A Christmas Carol. You've never seen either one of those.
Or, I mean, even like a Muppet Christmas Carol?
Yeah,
like,
you've never
there's
seen
so many different interpretations of that story.
Yes. She has never seen any of them. Not one.
Wow.
Yes. So now, while in between her god-awful Hallmark movies that she has on the television at all times, that I'm going to make her watch Scrooged and A Christmas Carol, because I love both of those. Jim Carrey's, even though it's a cartoon, it is so awesome. It was great in 3D, too.
Yeah, no, I've actually never seen that version of it. I do need to see that.
It's really, really good. And because it's a cartoon, they can kind of have a little bit more fun with it.
Right.
But it is such a good film. It really is one that I have to watch every single Christmas.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, yes, I am, well, as a matter of fact, in the Christmas spirit.
That kind of became a long conversation,
yeah,
but
no,
I'm okay
no,
with
it. Really
it
really is, because it's either that or watching stupid Hallmark movies. And, I mean, let's be honest. How many times can you see the big executive from the big city go to the small town and fall in love? I mean, how many times can you see that? Because that
right,
happens every time.
And you know it's all going to somehow work out in the last 5 minutes.
Exactly.
Of the movie.
Either her family.
My grandfather loves those things.
I can't stand them.
I'm the same way.
Before she started DVRing these things, I had about 60% free space on our DVR. It's down to 28 because all she has done is DVR those movies, and they're horrific.
I've noticed that Netflix and some of the streaming services have tried to horn in on that market. They've been coming out and been really promoting some of those feel-good Christmas movies here recently.
I tried to lie to her and tell her that an episode of Jessica Jones was a Christmas story. Yeah, the first time the person stabbed themselves in the neck, it was done. Kilgore just did it in four. I can never get her to watch Jessica Jones ever again.
You know, that was the only of the Marvel series on Netflix that I really didn't care much for.
I actually like it the most.
Really?
But yes, because it's more believable. The reason why I say it's more believable is, I know that Iron Man, you have your Iron Man stuff, and you have this rich guy that's able to make equipment. You have Thor, and you have, you know, the Hulk and all that. But even Daredevil is a lot more believable. But with Jessica Jones, like, that is such a good story. It deals with stuff that's going on right now, what we were talking about earlier, about people being told and made to do stuff that they don't want to do. But at the exact same time, I love David Tennant. Like, I loved him in Doctor Who.
Mm.
And so to see him as Kilgore and to still have a little bit of that Doctor Who side connected to it, because he still has, obviously, Doctor Who becomes who you are.
Right.
Like the character becomes your personality. So every single doctor has their own little individual interpretation of who the doctor should be, but they're also part of who they really are in real life. So you see a little bit of the doctor in it at the same time that you're trying to figure out, should I hate this guy? Because literally I could look at you and say, stab yourself in the neck, and you would do it because that's his power. And at the same time, you kind of feel bad for him because he was tested on as a kid. So it's this really awesome character development.
Yeah, I will say that I did think that the villain, Kilgrave, in that particular story.
Yeah, Kilgore, yeah.
Yeah, Kilgore is different. That's from the Styx song.
That's exactly, yeah.
Anyway.
Sorry about that.
No, the thing that I was going to bring up is I don't necessarily have a problem with that. It's just that, for me, Jessica Jones herself is not a likable character, and that's the problem that I have with it.
And for me, I think that they cast that character perfectly, because the girl that plays that, if you've seen other stuff that she's been in, whether it was Breaking Bad, Don't Mess with the Bee from Room 23 or whatever that name of that show
is. See, I
never
saw that one.
Yeah, that is who she is. Like, that is her that's her personality in a lot of shows. She's this girl that I don't really give a crap about you. I'm going to be the B word to you, and that's just who I am.
Well, now, that is accurate to the Jessica Jones of the comics.
Yes.
But I just don't like the Jessica Jones of the comics either. I'm not a fan of the character, and that's why it was hard for me to get into it.
And for me, I love the torn person, the person that has had a real tough life, who doesn't, you know, has all these people that she's hurt. I love the story. I love how deep the story actually gets. But in me and being all the in philosophy and all that sort of stuff, I love seeing the mental twist that the whole show took.
Well, I tell you what I'm going to try to do tonight is I'm trying to go, since we're talking about, you know, media and pop culture and everything, I'm going to try to go see Star Wars so I can give my review of it tomorrow.
So here's what I plan, because I'm going to be off next week. My vacation is next week.
Right.
There are a lot of movies that my wife will not go see. Thor, Star Wars, Justice League.
Oh, man.
She don't.
It's so sad.
She won't go see any of it. I actually got her to watch Logan, and Logan she was into.
Now, Logan was phenomenal.
Yeah, Logan was a tremendous movie. It's a tremendous movie, period. Not just a tremendous Marvel movie. So what I have done is I'm going to, every single day next week, I'm going to the movie theater to see one of these movies that she refuses to go see. So that's my vacation. That's my entire vacation. And it started off, or it's going to start off on Monday when I'm going to go see Star Wars. Then I'm going to go see Thor and Justice League. And through all of this, I just got excited because the 21st Century Fox deal that just took place. Because they just sold all the rights to Disney. So
right.
That means that Deadpool and X-Men can be a part of the Marvel Universe.
That's right.
And so now
the Marvel Universe is finally coming together.
So Hugh Jackman, get the claws back, buddy. Let's go ahead and knock this sucker
now,
out.
Now, he said he's not going to do it.
He is going to do it.
But here's the thing, and this is the thing that a lot of people aren't thinking about. He did say in an interview, and I remember reading this,
yes,
that the only way that he would return to the Wolverine role is if Wolverine became part of the Marvel Universe.
Yes. So just
so
go
that
ahead
is
and
a possibility now.
And here's what's great is they even made a point to talk about Deadpool the other day. And they even said when this was taking place is that there is a spot for rated R movies in the Disney Marvel Universe. So that means that, is it Bob Iger? Is that the guy's name?
I don't remember.
Anyways. He says that he wants Deadpool sequels and they will be rated R. So I'm like, all right, I'm okay with that now. If you give me rated R Deadpool, then we are all good to go. Give me rated R Deadpool.
I'd rather have PG-13 Deadpool, honestly.
Oh, but I love rated R Deadpool, man.
I watched the filtered version with a lot of the stuff taken out, and it only shaved off about 5 minutes and was still a really funny movie.
I'm telling you, Deadpool, and again, that's another one, just like Jessica Jones. Because of how Ryan Reynolds is in real life,
He was the perfect
fit. He
cast
was the perfect
that.
Fit. It was absolutely the perfect fit because he was not acting. That is him. Like that is his jokes. Those are his lines. Like that is him. It's like Bill Murray in Caddyshack.
There's three characters in the Marvel Universe that I can say this about, and it's Ryan Reynolds, Hugh Jackman, and Robert Downey Jr. So Deadpool, Wolverine, and Iron Man.
Yes.
That I think really what happens is they don't even write lines for them. They just kind of put them in costume and put them on set, say roll, and just record it for a few minutes, and they're like, all right, you're done.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just who they are.
It's because, and that's it. And that's why I go back to Jessica Jones, is because that girl is the perfect character or the perfect person to play that character. And I'm infatuated with it. I love David Tennant in those shows. And that's the reason why there's certain people that are just so fit for a movie role. And so now the fact that they have sold X-Men and Deadpool to Disney, just give me more Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. That's all I want. So there we go.
Well,
that's it. That's way better than talking about Jose Canseco.
It kind of was, honestly. And let's be honest, that was more fun.
Yes.
All right, but thank you, Joe, for being here. I appreciate it. We're going to have the Chaplain's Report coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Matthew 22:37-40. And he said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets."
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in, but we do have the Chaplain's Report coming up right now. There has been a movement recently that there's an idea amongst people who claim to be religious that you can be spiritual and godly and have a right relationship with Christ completely independent of any kind of church family or church body. And I reckon that there is an aspect of that that is true, that if you were someone that was, for example, stranded on a desert island or something like that, that you could be saved, that you could have a relationship with Christ. However, this idea, this sort of go-it-alone mentality and not belonging to a church, that's never something that has come from the Bible. That's not an idea that is based in Scripture. And it's not what God would imagine and what he wanted for people that were following him. And so it's certainly not God's ideal. I guess it's theoretically something that you could do if you were in a vacuum, but it's not what God wants for his people. And we get that idea from the Scripture. Let's go to Philippians 2:1-4. "Therefore, if any is encouragement in Christ, if there is any consolation of love, if there is any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and compassion, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interest, but also for the interest of others." This is Paul talking to a congregation of believers, asking that for them to make his joy complete, that they need to be this close-knit family of God that the Lord has always intended for people that are a community of faith. This whole go-it-alone mentality, that's not an idea that comes from Scripture, and it's not what God wants for us. We're supposed to be able to rely on one another, to depend on one another, to look to each other in times of hardship, and strengthen one another in faith. That was always part of God's design, that we belong to a church family. And we fulfill that vision that he has by, what does he list here? Encouragement, consolation, affection, compassion. These are the tools that we use to grow alongside one another as people of a common faith. And once that happens, once that works, once you belong to that community and belong to that fold that God has always envisioned for his people, it really does change who you are and what you think, and it strengthens you spiritually. Spirituality does have an aspect of community that goes along with it, and that makes sense. God made us to be communal creatures. He made us to belong with one another. He gave us that desire and that innate ability to connect with one another for a reason. And joy being one of the chief tenets of Christianity, Paul is pleading with them to make his joy complete, to increase in his joy, by saying that unity and fellowship are the ways to do that. That seeing other people, being around other people that are united, that do come together for a common cause, that love one another and love you, is part of what makes that joy complete. How do we accomplish this? Paul's actually puts it pretty simply here. By humbly putting aside our needs, humbly putting aside what we want and what we think may necessarily be best for us, in the hope of and with the intent of putting the needs of others ahead of ourselves. That's what he envisioned. That's what he wanted. And that really is who we are supposed to become as a people. That's what God envisioned for us. So we put aside the needs of ourselves and put the needs of others ahead of us. Now, that is true inside the church and outside the church. Now, that is the case. But he's specifically talking here to a group of believers when he says this. You see, we cannot be disciples of Christ if we cannot learn to do what Jesus did. If we want to be followers of Jesus, we have to follow in his footsteps and do what he did in our own lives. And this is the epitome of who Christ was, putting the needs of other people ahead of his own. Just coming to earth in the first place was an act of doing that. And so everything in Christ's life was centered around putting his needs aside to help other people. And I've got to be honest, kind of looking at this with my own lens, I honestly do not understand how people live life without a church family. I don't see how they do it. Now, maybe that is because I've just happened to have one my entire life. I've had to, you know, become a part of a new church family several times because of when I moved for college or whatever. But when that happens, I don't see how people do it without having a body of believers and people around them that encourage them. And maybe I'm even more aware of it now because of what I've been going through recently. I've always been an introverted person by nature. I'm not necessarily someone who's a social butterfly that always has to be around people. But in this regard, in this sense, I've always understood and been appreciative of the fact that there were people around me that cared about me, that wanted to be around me, and that had that same common faith that Paul is talking about here. So I think that what is great about the holidays in this is that we realize how much that we really, really do need one another, how much we depend on one another. So take the time you have this season and make others a priority. If you want to do what Paul is suggesting, make joy complete. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.